Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever or whenever you are. This is the Lightning Podcast, where we discuss and explain the weekly meditations without necessarily reaching any conclusions. Welcome. I'm your host, Cyrus Polizbon. I'm joined today by Zohar Atkins, Ann Dudek, Genevieve Kim, and Francis Pedraza. Welcome, everybody. Today's quote of the week is by Simone de Beauvoir, and it is, "Art, thought, and passion can be neither personal nor private. They are the levelers of the individual." Again, art, thought, and passion can be neither personal nor private. They are the levelers of the individual. Zohar, what does that mean?
Great. So first thing, let's just give a brief overview of Simone de Beauvoir. She was one of the great existentialist philosophers of the 20th century, and she was a co-author and thought partner as well as lover of Jean-Paul Sartre, who famous for writing Being and Nothingness. She also wrote The Second Sex, which is sort of a classic in feminist philosophy. And this quote sends the mind for some kind of tangle, because we think of thought, art, and passion as things that are intensely private and personal. When I think about what makes for something personal, I think about an experience that I can't communicate to others. Passion is difficult to put into words, the experience of making or enjoying a work of art likewise, and thought, probably for myself, the most personal. So she's contrarian, and we have to understand the nugget of truth in her contrarian take here. But before we get into that, let's also just highlight the word levelers of the individual. Levelers, what does the level mean? So in carpentry, to level something is to flatten. Or you might hear in military context, like Rome was leveled, like it was raised, it was turned into something flat. So art, thought, and passion level the individual, as in they destroy or flatten the individual. And that means that there's something in all of these things that connects us to one another and that takes away that which makes us individual. So I probably opened up even more of a can of worms in my explainer. Because it raises the question of what is an individual? An individual means that which can't be divided, literally indivisible. So levelers of the individual means the, things which can be divided, things which can be shared, things that are transferable, as opposed to things which are non-transferable or non-fungible. So we still haven't answered the question of how art, thought, and passion level the individual, but that is her claim that they do. And then I'll give a thesis or a hypothesis, and then open it up to others to think about. What if the experience of all of these is so intense that we need to share them? Kant thinks that the definition of beauty, the experience of beauty, is such that it can't be contained in the individual, because by definition, you want to validate your experience by telling someone else about it. And I think social media actually bears this out. You don't just want to go see a movie by yourself. You want to go to a movie and then tell everybody what you thought about it. You want to go read the review. And so thought actually ends up being quite a network thing. Same for art and same for passion. Passion needs an object. And then the non-individual aspect of all of these is also the realization that there are certain structures or patterns to them that are repeatable across culture, across time. And I think that's part of what the Lightning Project is trying to reveal, is that we can open up a work of thought or a work of art from 3,000 years ago or 500 years ago and actually see commonality there. And that should level the individual. That should make us feel that we're not as special as we think, and that we need to rethink what makes us special in light of that.
We are the same. Awesome. Anyone have any thoughts on that? No.
Yeah, I think everyone has like a lot of thoughts on that, which is part of the problem, which is why everyone's so quiet.
Space. I found that to be the explanation of the quote. And I thought maybe she was getting at that possibly there was some kind of shared, I mean, you could argue that there is a shared experience or a shared spirit among people, living beings, but I don't think that's what she was going for, but you could spin the quote that way. Could you not?
Well, I think that based on what Zohar was talking about, I had a similar thought, Cyrus, which is, especially with art, I think like when art is really successful, it sort of is an individual representation of a kind of fundamental universal human truth. And so I think that when you kind of look at it through the lens of what Zohar said, is that the idea of sort of this universal humanity or creating something that can speak across humanity is a leveler, right? And it's not necessarily a negative thing, but it's saying that there's sort of this fundamental commonality that art and passion and thought kind of speak to in all individuals. And I think that is really relevant to what Zohar said about the Lightning Project, where you can look at art from, you know, 15,000 years ago and still see, still understand it, like still get moved by it. You can look at art from 200 years ago or 2 weeks ago and have those similar experiences. So it does sort of transcend time and level like the individual into their humanity.
Yeah.
I think one of the great debates, one of the great debates in philosophy is what actually is private, what actually is personal, what is a person. You could tell a broad story in which for a long time, the sort of in the pre-liberal, pre-modern age, there was no such thing as the individual. The individual was barely evident and people focused on the unit being the tribe. And then sort of as we became more modern and more self-critical and self-reflective, the individual emerged as that which doesn't conform. And that kind of peaks, if you will, with Romanticism, which is this idea in the 18th and 19th century that society just doesn't get it. and the truth is inside of you. And, you know, Rousseau, I think, is a great proponent of this idea, sort of actually coming out of Luther, that if there's any friction or tension whatsoever between your inner world and what society is giving back to you, it's society that is wrong. And just double down on your inner life. But then there's a boomerang effect from this sort of hyper-individualism in the 20th century. And Beauvoir is, I think, pointing to this, which is the idea that we think we're special and we think that we're unique, but it turns out that your inner life that you thought was hyper important has the exact same features as the next person's inner life. And that romanticism in a way is cliched, and look at all of the thought patterns and all the things that you desire. And isn't it interesting that everyone in the same time and place has those same desires and the same thoughts and feelings? And maybe we're mind controlled by billboards or, you know, whatever. So Wittgenstein famously says that there's no such thing as private language. And that suggests that you couldn't communicate with just yourself, that inherent in the medium of language is already other people's thoughts and ideas.
I want to replace the word in my head with original. Like, nothing is original, but at the same time, everything is original. It's in at least in writing or in the entertainment industry and making movies, the idea, or in music or any art, the idea that, especially today, there's like, oh, all the tropes have been filled. It's like, well, yes and no. Like, every story is the same group of beats. It's like the Tao Te Ching is like, okay, there's like 64 scenarios of the human life, and that's it. You know,
I Ching.
The I Ching. Obviously, I'm the least learned here. But the I Ching's list, the 64 hexagrams of each one representing a human life scenario. And it's like, that's it? Like, just 64? Of course we've repeated them. But it's like the combination of them together is what makes the uniqueness. And so the same with the story, the art, someone's thoughts is like, you've had, someone else has had this thought and someone else has had that, you know, like your unique grouping of them makes it different and yet not. And it's just like cooking.
Yeah. I got to give one contrarian take on this and then I'll shut up. Peter Thiel in 0 to 1, has this incredible, idea that people who have a monopoly want to downplay it and people who don't want to act like they have one. And so the relevance here is that the more original you are, the more you want to act like you're just like everyone else. And the less original you are, the more you're like, oh, I have the biggest invention. You've never seen anything like this. So not to psychoanalyze Simone de Beauvoir, but it's, I wonder if we should take this as a truism or if this is a certain vibe. And actually the esoteric meaning of it is that she's hyper original, but because being original comes with the cost of being lonely and other, that it's helpful for those kind of radical creatives to say, no, we're all the same. And the individual is leveled by these things like passion and art and thought.
There is an element of truth to that, at least in terms of artists that I've known. But that quote about monopolies just sounds like Sun Tzu. When you are strong, act weak. When you're weak, act strong. Francis, like that.
Yeah. No,
well, I actually want to go back to this word levelers, because to me, what if we actually replaced levelers with transcends? And because if I think about like what the purpose of art is, or, you know, art as a path, like if I think about, you know, art as a practice, it could be seen as like a practice of devotion, right? Or like, you know, in like the yoga tradition, it would be like bhakti. And so you're finding some sort of like this transcendental experience, right? Of the other, and that therefore is like not necessarily about the individual, right? It's overcoming that. And it's actually going to purusha, right? This is this concept of actually just pure consciousness rather than it being about prakriti, which is like just matter and nature. Like that's, you know, or ego, right? And like, maybe that's where we get to this ultimate thing of liberation, right? Because I think about context of like where this comes from. It's Simone de Beauvoir. It's from her Ethics of Ambiguity, right? And that ambiguity is actually ultimately what sort of kind of enables us to get to this point of freedom. So I'm sure Simone de Beauvoir was not trying to respond to Patanjali, but my mind kind of went there. And I thought, oh, interesting. What about transcending the individual, transcending this, the I, right? Or the ego. Yeah.
But what you just did there by comparing ancient Indian thought and French existentialist 20th century thought is the point of the quote, right?
Yeah.
All thoughts are playing with the same substance. They're playing with thoughts, and so they can interrelate, and that's the medium of language. I believe, Zohar, you mentioned Wittgenstein, right? So everything ever expressed in language that is intelligible in language in any language at any time is in a conversation with everything else said in language. In the same way that when you buy a latte for say $5, the price of that latte is linked to the price of all things on the planet, on the planet, because we have a global market. And so the price of the most expensive artwork, the price of, you know, a home in Thailand, the price of a company in Brazil, the price of a steak in Australia, and the price of your latte wherever you are all
of your time
inextricably linked. And if you can understand that economic concept, you can understand the linguistic, literary, and civilizational concept, which is that everything is linked and by history and by the great conversation. And this is what the classics are about, the great conversation. So you are in the great conversation. However, whenever a fork is created in the road like this, our thought and passion can neither be personal or private. They are the levelers of the individual. It's good to reverse it and just literally write the sentence. Let's go ahead and do the exercise of writing the sentence that makes the opposite statement. And you can actually keep playing with this. So this is like a Zen circle. So our thought and passion can only be personal and private. They are the elevators of the individual. Oh my God, what an incredible quote.
So true.
And then to complete the Zen circle, you actually should start playing with other reversals, because there's usually at least four primaries, you know, in a compass rose. So art, thought, passion can only be personal and private. Art, let's put the opposite of art: science, emotions, and what's the opposite of passion? Incentives.
Action, actually, because passion means passivity.
Oh, interesting. Even that, most people think about passion and they think about action. So, like, what's up with that? Science, emotions, and actions can only be personal and private. And then we can now go do the other one, which is they can be neither personal nor private. They are the levelers of the individual. So in case you weren't following, I'm just going to reread the four statements. And by the way, this is a thought tool. So I'm giving you a piece of software. You can apply this with any statement that you're ever confronted with and try to do the compass rose. This is called the Zen circle.
But depending on whether it's personal or private, you will or won't be able to monetize this piece of software.
Yeah. There you go. All right. The original statement by Simone de Beauvoir in The Ethics of Ambiguity: art, thought, and passion can be neither personal nor private. They are the levelers of the individual. Variation one: art, thought, and passion can only be private and personal. They are the elevators of the individual. Variation two: science, emotions, and actions can only be personal and private. They are the elevators of the individual. Science, emotions, and actions can be neither personal nor private. They are the levelers of the individual. What's really going on? We're at a crossroads where there are four roads. Which of these four statements are true, or are all of them true? And the question is actually more interesting to zoom out from the crossroads and look down at the crossroads from above. Why is there a crossroads right here?
Right here being?
Let's assume there were four schools of historical thought. There were the people that went to the north. There were the people that went to the west. There were the people that went to the east and the people that went to the south. And they created four different civilizations based off of a fundamental belief. Based off of the people who believed in the Simone de Beauvoir quote went north, the people who believed in variation number one went east, and the people who south and west. What would become of those four peoples? And would they forever disagree? Would they fight wars over these statements? Why is this crossroads right here on the map?
They would have a Francis in each civilization who would do the compass rose to their primary source and do this thought experiment and deconstruct the divisions and try to find the other Francises and the other civilizations and find the point of commonality. And then they would be scapegoated by their societies for lacking loyalty to the primary truth.
Yeah.
And I think we should get George R.R. Martin to write it. So
yeah, exactly. Perfect.
They would found lightning, all of them.
A game of Zens.
Game of Zens.
When you were talking about the latte, I was tempted to make a joke about liquidity. Because while we're all interconnected, some verbal asset classes are more liquid than others. And it's easier to see the commonality between, let's say, one school of thought and another. And with other statements or concepts, there's sort of the reach is a stretch, and the sort of the market is not efficient. And so when you take these examples of these four different quotes, I think the question will be, do people find that they have immediate use and value, in which case you'd say that that these concepts have liquidity, or are they the kinds of esoteric teachings that only a few people believe in? And that would be the private equity model. And the hope that while most people dismiss them as gibberish or pseudo wisdom, that they're going to hold them until the market shifts from being a voting machine to a weighing machine.
I understood what you just said. It's so brilliant that it should be unpacked. And I'm sure that you lost most of the audience with that. So let's go through what he said. So in finance, liquidity is, let's just take me, for example. My net worth, if it is anything that is, above something close to zero, is entirely tied to invisible stock. I own a lot of invisible stock. Now, it is difficult for me to sell invisible stocks. 4 years ago, it was impossible for me to sell invisible stock in a secondary transaction because there's just not enough demand for the stock. But when there's enough demand for the stock after the company becomes valuable enough, so it has to get to a certain scale for people to actually want to buy it. And then once they want to buy it, then if there's a market for buyers and sellers, the price starts to become something close to what I think its value is. And then you can sell it. Now, when a company goes public in the stock market, those markets are facilitated and there's liquidity, and then you can convert your specific security, invisible stock, invisible shares in this Delaware C corporation, into US dollars. And then what are US dollars? US dollars are a currency that is inherently liquid. It's a currency of exchange that can then be converted into other currencies like roses for Mother's Day, or your latte, or your rent check this
dollars
month.
Dollars are levelers of the individual,
right?
Whereas shares of invisible are elevators of the individual.
That's the second the second part of your comment, which is that you might think, okay, what's valuable here? Are US dollars valuable, or is invisible stock valuable? Like, why would you want to convert something into something liquid, or why would you want to convert something into something illiquid? And you start to realize, okay, the things that are illiquid are things that are generally not understood or appreciated, but that's actually where all the, and this is another finance term, alpha is. So if you want to build wealth and get way ahead, you need to take some position in economics, for example, like starting a company that nobody thinks is valuable and you think it's going to be very valuable someday. And then at some future point, then there's convergence and then everyone's opinions converge. You're like, no, actually this is valuable. And that's how you create wealth. So now Zohar is making in his jokey way that like, I feel like we should do a series of almost like New Yorker style cartoons. We should title it like The Revenge of the Nerds or something like that, where statements like some verbal asset classes are more liquid than others are made by like the kid who's bullied on the playground to the kid who's bullying him. And it's like some verbal asset classes are more liquid than others. And like the bully, like the meathead bully's like, huh? You know? But
clearly that statement wasn't very liquid, Francis.
But what Zohar is getting at is that in philosophy, just like in entrepreneurship and just like in capitalism, the biggest gains are made from people who diverge the most from the common understandings. That's what you were saying. That's my translation.
Exactly. That was beautiful. Exactly. The most illegible things, while often worth zero or less than zero, occasionally massively outperform the things which are obviously intelligent by definition. And so just as a company by definition is making a statement, literally a thesis, that it knows something that others don't know, that is how we should think about any sentence in the history of philosophy. What does this sentence know that others don't know? The extent to which you can find many examples of that same sentence in the same time horizon. The more it's not deviating from the norm, the more it's simply a piece of philosophical beta. The more it's inscrutable and koanic, and what does that mean? The more, again, it could be complete gobbledygook and go to zero, like most venture bets go to zero, but it could also return the fund by 3 to 5x, in which case that's all you need. You're betting on outliers.
Zohar just said a bunch of things that anyone who understands venture capital will just be like mind blown by what he just said. And then anyone who doesn't understand it will be like, what's going on?
Sorry, I keep explaining illegibility by being more illegible, which is the point that I keep making, which is that value potentially inheres in things which deviate from legibility. So the more frustrated you are that you don't understand, the more you may be right that I'm full of it, or the more you might want to wonder if the path to a tremendous outcome is following this crazy guy.
Yeah, we should talk about, and as it relates to this, we should talk about Thales and the maid, the Thracian maid. So there's a story, this goes back to before Socrates, I think 500, 600 BC, maybe, I don't know how far back Thales was, maybe even farther back, and around that time in ancient Greece. And Thales was one of the pre-Socratic philosophers, and he was not only a philosopher, he was so far-seeing. He made a fortune by being one of the first commodities traders. He realized, was there going to be what was the famine that was? It was like olive oil. Like, he thought there was going to be an olive oil famine or something. So he bought a bunch of olive oil, and then it turns out he was right. And then he made a bunch of money.
He actually, well, there's different variations on it, but he's a hero to Nassim Taleb, who's a sort of contemporary skeptic and philosopher of finance. And the idea is he made a bunch of money on wheat futures.
Yeah.
But crucially, it's not that he had a strong thesis on the future price of wheat or whether there would be or wouldn't be a shortage. It's simply that he understood optionality, which is the idea that a future might be a certain way and that most people haven't priced that in. And so rather than taking a primary position on whether wheat is going to go up or down, he simply bought the option to buy wheat into future, knowing that there's a chance that wheat could go up in price. And if it did, he would become rich. So he was one of the first Western thinkers to actually understand and enact optionality. And at a meta level, he was one of the first philosophers to prove that, look, philosophers aren't just head in the clouds, disconnected from the world. If they wanted to get rich, they could. They're just not interested in it. So sort of like proving the critics of philosophy, like, listen, dude, I could play your game, but why would I want to? But fine. Just, you know, you need a miracle here. Look, I did it.
Yes. Yes. Like a wizard, right? Who's being forced to perform magic to prove that they're a wizard. It's like, okay, fine. I'll show you that I know something. And philosophy and economics are inherently linked through the concept of value and values. So again, going back to the latte, if you don't believe that life is worth living, right? If you're like borderline, you know, nihilistic, suicidal, like, then you're not going to buy a latte. You're not even going to buy food. Nothing has any value to you, right? If you believe that caffeine is awful, you're not going to buy a latte. There's a whole bunch of beliefs that turn into values that mean that to you, it's worth nothing. And so in Anne coin or Genevieve coin or Zohar coin or Cyrus coin or Francis coin, you know, you only buy something when it's worth more to you than the dollars you're giving up. And so you're always profiting in your value system when you buy, if it's a free and willing transaction. And this is why you separate the concepts of money and value in economics. So values, thinking about, well, you know, this is where the philosopher becomes the economist. If you have a strong disagreement with the world about what is valuable, you should be able to express that in an economic position, not just a philosophical position. Everyone else thinks this thing over here is not valuable. I think it's the most valuable thing in the world. Why? some philosophical reason. Okay, fine. I'm going to buy that. In Francis coin, I'm wealthier than all of you. And that's what matters to me anyways. And if you guys eventually realize it, the price of this will go up. And even if you don't realize it, I'm okay because I have the thing that I think is valuable. And so Thales was this guy, all right? And guess what? He's looking, he's literally, his head is in the clouds. He's looking up and he's walking along the street and he falls into a well. Like a clueless guy, right? And then there's some lady on the street and she just literally laughs at him. She's like, ha, 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 look at that guy. His head is so in the clouds. He's such a useless philosopher. He like can't even like see where he's walking and he just stumbles into a well. What an idiot. And who was it who said that this was the essential predicament of everyone who is committed to thinking is basically being mocked in this moment. So if you're listening to the Lightning Podcast, if you're the sort of person who receives our daily meditations, if you're the sort of person who's interested in the classic books and art and music, and you hear this story of Thales falling into the well and being laughed at because his head was in the clouds, you're being laughed at, right? And it goes to the basic trauma of the thoughtful person, which is that you the deeper you go into your own thoughts and into thinking, the harder it is for normal people to understand you. And the bigger the distance becomes between you and the rest of society, and the more you sort of become an individual, and in becoming an individual, become other, become separate. And then going back to the Beauvoir quote, you know, she's making the claim that, well, the irony of the thinkers is that they're all connected. They're not actually thinking private thoughts. And so now we're in a bind. Does thinking actually separate us from the rest of society and make us individuals? Or does thinking actually connect us with all thinkers and therefore make us not individuals?
Both.
It depends where you are in the business life cycle. You start out illegible and then you IPO. you start out as an individual and then eventually the market becomes efficient and all of a sudden it's like, oh, duh. You didn't say anything new. It's like you weren't saying that 10 years ago.
Yeah.
The greatest compliment we pay to thinkers is telling them that they're cliched.
Yes.
That's the IPO.
That's the IPO.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
You're right.
Yeah, you're
That's
so right.
Myth. That's the myth. Last night I was listening to a Native American mythology of the Lakota tribe. And the stories were so good. I cried. They're so good because they're so universal, right? Like you could have told those stories to any people at any time and they would have had the same emotional reaction that I did, pretty sure. And so what's the significance that they came from the Lakota after all?
Right. It could have been from anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. We can listen to this stuff when we're on Mars and it's going to be still so good.
It always feels that way in retrospect, but like in retrospect, we say, oh, it doesn't matter whether Newton or Leibniz invented calculus. Like if not them, someone would have eventually invented calculus, but from their perspective and the perspective of their contemporaries, they are the inventor. So it's one of those sort of macro versus micro things where when you take a macro view, we all seem insignificant. But when you take a micro and first person view, it's hyper significant. And I'm reminded of this quote that has haunted me from the Book of Esther, which is in the Bible, in which Mordecai says to Esther, this is at a time when Esther is the queen of the entire Persian kingdom, but it's not known that she's Jewish. And there's just been an edict against the Jews that the Persians are going to kill all of them. And Esther has to go and tell the king, hey, I'm Jewish and you should reverse this decree. And her uncle says to her, like, you need to go and do this and save your people. But if you don't, salvation will come from somewhere else. And it's like this moment where she has a unique opportunity because of her position to be a hero for all time. But at the same time, if she doesn't exercise that heroism, don't worry. Providence is going to come in anyways. And so really it's like, do you want to be the agent who enacts this, this heroism? But it's this weird psychological thing where the world depends on you and also doesn't depend on you at the same time.
Someone's going to play the part. You can either choose to get cast or not, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And she takes it up. But I almost wonder if, like, the fact that she's been exonerated because of the destiny aspect is what actually motivates her to take it. Like, not the, I want to save my people and they depend on me. But, like, you're damn right I want that part.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like how if I'm going to give that to some other Esther?
Yeah.
I think there was a marketing campaign in like the early 2000s when I was a kid from McDonald's when they still had like the tearaway things on cups and they had the sweepstakes. And it was like, it was basically that whole sentiment. It was like, somebody's going to be a millionaire. Why not you? And like, I actually repeat that to myself daily. I'm like, oh, why not me? Yeah. Cool, I'll do it. And it like actually like makes insurmountable things seem so simplistic. It's like, oh yeah, I'll just do that. And like, it's honestly like a really, really great motivator to kind of like have that pressure taken off of you, but then simultaneously like also decide to do that thing. I think about that ad campaign from McDonald's on a weekly basis. So
yeah. That's, yeah. Someone's going to do it. So someone's done it. Might as well do it.
I'm just picturing Leibniz, like, getting that McDonald's takeaway and being like, dude, calculus is mine.
Newton drops the cup that's holding his Coca-Cola, and he's like, gosh darn it. I guess I gotta figure this shit out.
And then he gets Sears and Carta and he's like, no, you're sharing the cap table with all of math.
Newton IPOs.
You've been diluted down to 5% of the stock.
Newton is like Elon. He IPOs calculus. Everyone's like, what a genius. And then he starts getting into bibliomancy and predicting the future based upon biblical codes. And like esoteric interpretations of the Book of Revelation, and people are like, oh, why'd you have to go and buy Twitter? What a distraction.
Oh man.
Oh my god.
I did have a thought on that delusion because it made me think of the Impressionists, where, you know, they like were so insane, they wouldn't even like, the school of the Beaux-Arts was just like, you cannot hang that stuff in here. And so they actually exhibited on a hillside across from the School of the Beaux-Arts. And like they were so radical that like they were taken out of all kind of like formal art circles. And now, talk about cliche, it's like printed on an umbrella that you can buy for like $4.99. And that's like what the Impressionists have become. Like, they're just like their pervasiveness in society when they were the pariahs at the time that they were making this art. And it really shows like that, you know, you're revolutionary, but you can become a cliche.
I feel that way whenever I see like a Rothko print in a hospital.
Yeah.
So I've been looking at this Midjourney image that we've generated for Simone de Beauvoir, and I've actually been, I don't know who generated it, who created this page. I don't know if you created this page, Zohar, or Nico did. I didn't create this page.
Nico. And
yeah. So there's something atavistic, and atavistic is from a Latin word. It means ancestral, like original, like primal. In a human looking at another human's face, right? We are just programmed to respond to the drama of a face and eyes. And when we see the eyes and we see the face, well, first of all, think about how unique faces are and how much information they carry about or imply, how much information they imply about this person's personality, their desires, their interests, their past, their future, their childhood, their ancestral lineage, whether they're a threat, whether they're potentially a friend, potentially a lover. There's so much in a face. And the crazy thing about an AI-generated face is that you're being tricked. Like this is not actually the face, and this is not actually the person. And it's very similar to art in that way, in that you can make a face that never existed before. And in that, I mean, Anne is the artist here. You know, in that action, you're sort of doing something pseudo magical or even pseudo divine, which is that you're creating the impression of a soul. And so I look at this unbelievable painting and I'm like falling in love with this woman. I'm like, I want to meet this woman. Who is this woman? I want to know everything about this woman.
You talking about which one?
Yes, exactly that one. Yeah. Which I suppose is the edutainment factor here, right? Like you create the right historical drama on Netflix, and suddenly everybody's interested in Napoleon or whatever. But I mean, I'm like, tell me everything that Simone de Beauvoir thinks. But then you look at this quote, art, thought, and passion can be neither personal nor private. They're the levelers of the individual. And I look at this woman and I'm like, no. Like the thought, when thought is born in a person, it's so intensely personal. Like there's different ways of looking at this through the gaze of romance, like looking at the person you fall in love with. You're not interested in them because they're just a someone of the opposite sex that you can reproduce with. You're gazing into a soul that is unique. And so that you're interested in their thoughts, their emotions, their experiences, their art, thought, and passion, them. And you can also think about this from a parenting perspective, children, right? Imagine like, you know, watching your child go through forming their first early thoughts and encouraging the development of thought. You're not going to say, oh, there's another human thought computer that's going to think the same basic thought patterns of every other human. It's the opposite. And what we call, I read recently in Joseph Piper's Leisure, the Basis of Culture, in his essay, The Philosophical Act, a beautiful definition of spirit, which is that the capacity for something in you to relate to something in the world. So think about a rock or a stone is not capable of relating to the world. It just sort of is inanimate in that way. A plant is related to the soil, an animal is related to its environment, but a human is capable of conceiving a world and building relationships with things in that world. And that is the interiority that matches the exteriority. I think if you destroy the intimacy of thought and the relationship of the individual to thought, you do somehow destroy thought. I'm not so sure that thought can just exist in an abstract sense like numbers. I think at the end of the day, all thoughts come down and are located in the soul of the individual. And that's why we look at a human face like Simone's and we're like, I want to learn from you. I want to read your book. If The Ethics of Ambiguity was not written by Simone de Beauvoir, but was just a book called The Ethics of Ambiguity that came from nowhere and was written by nobody and was just spit out by monkeys writing on typewriters, it would just not be worth reading. It's only interesting because it's hers.
We have very little time left. I want everyone to give their closing thoughts. One line, if any. I'd like to end on that. If no one has any more thoughts.
No thoughts, just vibes.
No Genevieve? Thoughts, just vibes.
I do want to switch this one thing out. I want to switch a few words out. Because yeah. Something that we talked to is a lot about time is like art and thought and passion, how there's threads, right? Over, and I would say that time is the leveler of the individual rather than art, thought, and passion. And that it can't, it's neither personal nor private.
I'm going to end with this thought. When Francis is talking about falling in love with the AI Beauvoir, I was thinking about a line from Bob Dylan, "For I was born too late, blame it on a simple twist of fate." And what you fell in love with was the AI Beauvoir, and the AI Beauvoir is now. The Beauvoir that you love isn't Beauvoir, but the AI Beauvoir. And so that itself, AI is the leveler of the individual. And the paradox we've been describing is evident actually in the fact that there's two Beauvoirs. There's the persona, the historical person who wrote the book, and then there's the persona that lives on through our imagination and now resurrected by AI. So you were too late for the first one, but the second one is right on time.
If your name is Simone and the year is 1928 and you live in Paris, France, and you're interested in very personal and private art, thought, and passion, let's level and elevate ourselves as individuals. My name is Jean-Paul, and my number on WhatsApp is +1 415 535 7171. Again, that's +1 415 535 7171.
That is his WhatsApp group that you can join. Thank you so much for joining us. If you're interested in more of this, you can find us on WhatsApp, Twitter, Instagram, Threads, LinkedIn. Thank you very much. Bye.